Iran, and they have supplied citizens with weapons, especially in when we have the state of chaos and lawlessness in the country. Now it is being feared that the area where there are tribal majorities, that there might be a war starting there as well. Because of continuing warring sites in Khartoum, it might spill over to the tribal area where these people now have weapons as well. But I mean, weapons don't usually just get dropped from the sky. Someone sends them these weapons. Who is pushing for a full-blown civil war inside of Sudan?
To get an idea of how the war will proceed in Sudan, we must first answer the question, how did the war in Sudan begin? The war there did not start by accident. It is a fabricated war that has been underway for a long time, for many years now, especially when the military was pushed to the forefront of the political process after the fall of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. With the intervention of external powers that wanted Sudan to slip into this kind of conflict or to be thrown into the arms of Israel. It was clear, for example, the UAE intervention in Sudan. The UAE is the one who arranged the relations between the generals of the Sudanese army, specifically between the two current fighting teams. The army commander Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the commander of the rapid intervention militia Mohammed Dagolo Hamiti on the one hand and the Israelis on the other. For example, Hamiti met in 2020 with Mossad chief Yossi Cohen in Abu Dhabi, even before Abu Dhabi itself signed the Abraham normalization agreement with the occupation entity. Likewise, the Emiratis themselves had mediated a meeting between Al-Burhan and Benjamin Netanyahu. So preparations were being made to take Sudan in a direction other than its natural position years ago. Today, we are seeing the result of that. Personally, I deem what is happening in Sudan as a reaction to what is happening on the other side of the Red Sea. And by that, I mean the political changes taking place in Yemen, for example, as a result of the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement. Therefore, I believe that efforts for solutions in the Arabian Peninsula are being responded to in Sudan under the leadership of the UAE. This is because the UAE finds itself outside these rapprochements because its bets are different. Its bets are intensely on the role of Israel and the role of the United States in the region.
It was interesting, Mr. Hussein, to listen to what the Sudanese army had to say after this clash that started almost 3 weeks ago. The army indicated that its forces has taken most of the control in the capital city, and they're speaking of a certain complicated situation in neighborhoods of the capital where the rapid forces of Hamiti have been deployed. But with the decline of the frequency of the clashes that we witnessed 2 weeks ago, it seems that there is some sort of an opportunity for a peaceful solution, a peaceful negotiation. But is this opportunity a regional one or an internal one? Is it just Sudanese, or are there other parties, other foreign states working towards it?
I think the war has not stopped yet. It is natural to see at the beginnings of wars when diplomatic efforts are at their height, although most of them are false efforts. Since these efforts are coming from the same parties that prompted the start of the fighting, such as the United States, Israel, and the UAE. However, it is normal at the beginning of any war that there exist intensive efforts to find a solution. Consequently, we will witness some decline in the clashes here and there. But how about any of the warring parties comes out to tell us why this war is happening? What does each side of this war want? Is one of these parties close to achieving its political goals? Is this war a problem in a lane between two men to end so quickly? And if the conflicts have already ended, shouldn't those who fought be held accountable for the disastrous results of this fighting? I mean, in a few days, hundreds of people were killed for no fault of their own. Does the blood spilled by these victims go to waste? So far, there is no talk of politics. So what is the point of this war? We only see belligerence in which one person asks the other to surrender and vice versa.
But we are actually seeing Egyptian efforts in here, which are being considered effective in the current crisis inside of Sudan, in addition to the presence of Egypt at the heart of this, because at the first day when it started, we had Egyptian generals in the hands of the Hamiti militia in Merwe in northern Sudan. So Cairo began to take steps that are received internationally in a positive way, with recognition by accepting refugees, by coordinating with mediators of the crisis, despite the fact that the mediators are Funnily enough, Israel and the UAE, as you mentioned, but will that be enough to savor Egypt from a spillover, especially that might affect its relationship with Ethiopia as well? Are we going to see a huge spillover in Africa?
Yes, it is possible to see a spillover or a transmission of the crisis to other countries. Unfortunately, I believe that Egypt, which is most affected by what is happening in Sudan, is the least effective in finding a solution to the crisis. In other words, the Egyptian efforts are near useless since Egypt is a weak country to some extent. Because its tools and diplomatic endeavors are weak, because it does not have many cards to employ in the diplomatic endeavors, you know that what plays a fundamental role in this crisis is money and weapons, as you mentioned in the first question. Money is driving this war. How do people fight without money and without weapons? And how do they fight? With what tools? Egypt does not have influence in this field, and therefore I do not think that the Egyptian efforts will lead to anything. On the other hand, Egypt is the most affected country by this war. Egypt, as you said, will be sought by the displaced in the beginning, being the main Arab country neighboring Sudan, and the fact that there is a good history between Egypt and Sudan. However, Egypt will inevitably be negatively affected, especially since other countries like Ethiopia are trying to exploit what is happening in Sudan for their benefit. We know that the Nile originates from Ethiopia, passes through Sudan and goes to Egypt, and it is the main lifeline for the Egyptians. What if he, who dominates Sudan, decides to join the Ethiopian team to play against Egypt's interests in the matter of the Nile?
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems from what you're saying that we are going to see more upcoming clashes and escalations inside of Sudan. We dearly want that not to happen. We wish the best for the Sudanese people. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hussein Ibrahim, political commentator and expert in Arab political affairs at the Daily Lebanese Al-Akhbar, for joining us to talk about this. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the suicide rates that are skyrocketing inside the Israeli occupation army members.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, top general of the Israeli occupation army has expressed concern over the soaring number of suicides among Israeli soldiers, calling on the authorities to deal with the challenge. Now, a study found that many suicides in the Israeli army were not only diagnosed with a psychological disorder, but that most of the soldiers who committed suicide suffered from anxiety for a long time about the future and lived in a state of constant frustration, extreme confusion, and a state of unending war and continuous fighting. More details in this following report.
The Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation, Kan 11, announced last week that three soldiers in the Israeli occupation army committed suicide during the last month, including two who committed suicide this past week. Kan 11 stated that a female soldier committed suicide on Thursday, while a male soldier committed suicide at the beginning of last week for unknown reasons, added to a third soldier that had committed suicide earlier in April. Zionist army officials are furious with these numbers because they consider that the publication of such data will encourage soldiers to commit suicide if they monitor the escalation of suicides in the ranks of the army. Meanwhile, Yadayot Ahranot newspaper reported that 14 Israeli soldiers committed suicide in 2022 while performing military service, with the highest toll in 5 years. Also, 11 Israeli soldiers committed suicide in 2021, while the highest rate of suicides in the ranks of the Israeli army was recorded in 2011, during which 21 soldiers committed suicide. Official statistics of the research center in the Knesset showed that the Israeli entity records 500 suicides annually, of which 100 cases are recorded among the young generation from 15 to 24 years old. Suicide is considered the second cause of death among those who enlist in the Israeli occupation army, whether from the period of rehabilitation through secondary education for conscription or during compulsory military service and even in reserve service. Data shows that 80% of suicides were recorded among males and 20% among females, and that 60% of suicides were recorded in the age group from the secondary stage of conscription to the age of 26 years. However, it seems that the number of suicides in the ranks of the Israeli army is higher than that, because in some cases, suicide is documented as a training accident or a road accident, which means deliberately concealing the true numbers of soldiers who committed suicide. It is inferred from the mental health unit in the Israeli occupation army that the growth of psychological disorders among the soldiers is the main reason for committing suicide. And this is due to psychological and social pressures, as well as their lack for sense of security and the state of war and continuous fighting. The Israeli study found that many suicides in the army were not only diagnosed with a psychological disorder, as most of the soldiers who committed suicide suffered from anxiety for a long time about the future and lived in a state of constant frustration, severe confusion, and a feeling of not belonging to the military framework. Estimates indicate that the manpower division in the Israeli army deliberately conceals facts about the prevalence of suicide and conceals the official and real number of soldiers who commit suicide annually. Suicide remains the main cause of death in the army if there are no Israeli military aggression campaigns.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire and producer and host of the Patrick Henningsen Show, which airs on TNT Radio. Thanks a million for being with us, Patrick, with this very pressing news coming from the Palestinian occupied territories. We have a Zionist Army Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi describing the soaring increase in the suicide cases among Israeli troops as dangerous and daunting challenge for the regime's armed forces. Now, compared to other military bodies around the world, the Israeli numbers are by far the highest. What do you think might be the main cause behind the suicide at such an early age, though?
So clearly there's something, there's a problem here. It must be something going on within the IDF ranks, within the military confines, or perhaps more broadly in society there. One of the things that we have seen, though, is that drug and alcohol abuse tripled among the youth and teenagers, and some of those during the COVID lockdown period. And of course, some of those would become of age and into military service in the last 2 years. So that's one of the things that we can definitely see that's clear. And just in the Israel society, in total, 1 out of 7 people suffer from some kind of addiction. That's about 15% of all of society. And, you know, societies that have a major drug problem, you often see signals of a rise in suicides as well. But the military poses its own unique set of problems. But, you know, as a country, according to global statistics, it's not shown as a massive uptick in overall suicide. So this appears to be a phenomenon that is definitely local to the military, and more specifically male conscripts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it seems that the number of suicides in the ranks of the Israeli army is actually higher than what the Israeli entity is declaring and revealing, because in some cases, suicide is being documented as accidents or a training accident or a road accident, which means deliberately concealing the true numbers of soldiers who are committing suicide within the occupation army. Nothing really, though, hides forever, especially inside of the Zionist entity. Then why are they resorting to deceit in such a pressing matter and with such high numbers?
Well, I would be myself somewhat cautious in speculating too much without seeing the hard evidence that there's actual misreporting going on with the official numbers, i.e., are they accurate or not? However, what I can point out is that this issue can be a devastating issue for public relations, for military, especially within recruitment. Mainly, and consider this fact, the United States, that since 9/11, suicides in the military have outpaced actual deaths in military operations. Just think about that for a minute. So, you know, the U.S. military has worked really hard to kind of minimize this, to cover it up, that there's a massive crisis here over the last 20 years. But now the numbers are out, and it's a totally devastating trend. Normally, the military will have lower suicide rates than society in general. But in the U.S., that trend is totally reversed. Why? Psychological issues. There's a sort of pathology that might be unique to that. And they're not counting veterans as well in those official numbers. And for the IDF, that might also be the case. If they were to count veterans, I'm sure you could talk about a much bigger overall crisis than what's being reported.
Well, Patrick, statistics indicate that the population groups of RICS that are at risk of suicide are among the Jewish colonial settlers, mainly who are from Russia, or the Falasha Jews and the African Jews, as well as among the elderly with the age group of 75 years. That's astonishing. It's being said that it's due to economic and social reasons, and that they are feeling somewhat alienated from the settler Israeli society. But knowing this fact, how do you perceive the recruitment procedure by the occupation entity, which takes the recruit out of the environment that he actually knows or she knows, and it's causing them great depression and disruption in their life, leading to suicide?
Well, with the immigration issue, it's interesting. I mean, looking at the studies, they are, quote, relatively high in comparison to other groups, looking at Ethiopians, immigrants, Jewish immigrants specifically. But we must also consider this fact that, Israel's rates is not in the top tier among nations. However, within the immigrant community, there's massive problems in Israel with integration difficulties, discrimination, language. These are all contributing factors which can be looked at. But overall, I'd say when considering immigrants, definitely it's the economic pressures, and I think that's throughout society as well, economic hardship, fluctuations in social welfare payments, employment problems. These are all primary drivers of clinical depression. Hence, you have to correlate that with suicide rates. And so that can also spill into the military population as well.
Well, we still have a bit of time here, Patrick. I want to ask you about this bit from a different perspective. I mean, if you look at it from outside, you see that there is a community that is being oppressed by the occupation, and then you have the settler occupation. Wouldn't it be more sensible to see such numbers, for example, in the Palestinian communities who are always under oppression, who are always besieged, for example, in Gaza? And still, in Gaza, the biggest open-air prison in the world, and we don't see such rates of suicide amongst the community of the Palestinians. Do you think that in another situation that should have been reversed, but it's not? What does that tell you about the settler colonial societies inside of occupied Palestine?
Well, I think it tells you, certainly you might be looking at a sort of a disconnect, a psychological disconnect with the sort of hypocrisy of the situation and the fact that, some people are just not younger people, especially coming, new generations coming in, they're not as maybe militant ideologically as their parents and grandparents were. So they might be feeling the hypocrisy of the situation. And this also feeds into clinical depression and other problems psychologically. So I wouldn't begin to speculate, as I'm not a clinical psychologist, but certainly there's plenty of issues there that would, if one was to study closely, that would be sort of gaping realities within the society.
It's like actually exporting the U.S. society or the Western society in general into that specific area, which is foreign to the communities around it. Because in all of the Arab communities, we don't see such high numbers of suicide. Suicide by itself is a notion that's unacceptable within the Arab world, within the Islamic and the Christian Arab world. And you still see some sort of an exporting of the Western values and ideologies and mental model, if you will, into the Israeli entity. Could that also be part of the problem?
Yeah, well, the Western progressive civilization just often does not live up to what it bills itself as. And I think we're starting to see that a backlash on that. And that can also be expressed in sort of, you know, severe psychological issues with people and turning to drugs, turning to alcohol just to cope with what is clearly a dysfunctional society. So, yeah, the Western model is definitely has a lot to be desired. Across the world, in fact. So these things are being challenged now.
Well, it is truly an interesting subject to dive into. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, and also host and producer of the Patrick Henningsen Show, which airs on TNT Radio. I advise you to listen to that. That's an amazing show. I like it a lot. Thank you very much, Patrick, for being with us. And ladies and gents, promise you to give you more updated news from the region of West Asia next week, inshallah, on the Middle East stream. Assalamu alaikum.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In 2001, the gross U.S. government debt reached $5.8 trillion, which was about 55% of America's gross domestic product, or GDP. But this debt in 2023, this year, has reached $31.4 trillion, which is nearly 125% of America's gross domestic product, or GDP. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Wall Street Journal has covered this story and tells us more. The United States Treasury has warned that the U.S. government will be unlikely to meet payment obligations by early June if the debt ceiling is not raised. The date is earlier than the Treasury estimated in January, indicating that the United States' financial situation is more precarious than previously thought. In a letter to Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, published on Monday, 1st of May, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen asked Congress to increase the government's debt ceiling before this date or to suspend its implementation in order to prevent economic turmoil. After reaching the borrowing cap of $31.4 trillion on 19th of January, Janet Yellen informed Congress that the Treasury would use cash receipts and extraordinary cash management measures to continue making payments on debt, federal benefits and other expenditures, at least through to 5th of June. Previously, economists had predicted Washington's debt would increase to the set limit by the end of early August, and the collection of less-than-expected tax revenues will speed the process. Experts believe the United States could default on its debt obligations if the debt ceiling is not raised by the summer, triggering an economic downturn that could result in a recession, create an unemployment crisis, and damage the country's reputation as a safe haven for investors. The economic outlook in the United States is clouded by a deepening rivalry between the Biden administration and Republican lawmakers, who are demanding drastic spending cuts in exchange for more government borrowing power. For the past 2 months, the White House has refused to talk to Kevin McCarthy and has demanded that the Republican-controlled Congress unconditionally approve the increase in the debt ceiling. President Joe Biden accused Republicans of holding the economy hostage to politically motivated demands and said he would discuss spending issues only in the context of the budget, not in relation to the debt ceiling. In the coming days, the Republican plan to increase the federal government's debt ceiling and reduce government spending will go to Congress. In 2011, a similar struggle over the debt ceiling brought the country to the brink of default, resulting in a downgrade of the United States' main credit rating. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered this story. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has sounded the alarm that a failure by Congress to raise the government's debt ceiling would eventually trigger an economic catastrophe. Janet Yellen said on Tuesday, 25th of April, at the Sacramento Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce Members Summit in Washington, she said, "A default on our debt would produce an economic and financial catastrophe." She added, "A default would raise the cost of borrowing into perpetuity. Future investments would become substantially more costly." Janet Yellen warned that failure by Congress to raise the government's debt ceiling and the resulting default on U.S. debt would result in job losses and higher interest rates for years to come. She also warned if Congress fails to do so, the government will likely run out of money to pay its bills. It will most likely be unable to issue payments to military families and to seniors who rely on Social Security, and U.S. businesses will face deteriorating credit markets, further adding that household payments on mortgages, auto loans and credit cards would all go up as well. Janet Yellen insisted that it was the basic responsibility of Congress to increase or suspend the $31.4 trillion borrowing cap set for the government without delay. She said, "Congress must vote to raise or to suspend the debt limit. It should do so without conditions, and it should not wait until last minute." After the January due date had expired, the U.S. Treasury Secretary told lawmakers in February that the government will likely run out of money by early June. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives is scheduled to vote in the coming days on raising the U.S. government's debt ceiling by $1.5 trillion. However, Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, suggested recently that the Republican plan would be to link their approval of an increase of $1.5 trillion to the debt ceiling to a decrease of $4.5 trillion in public spending. Treasury says the two issues should not be linked, and the Democratic-controlled Senate is likely to reject the GOP plan amid a standoff between Democrats and Republicans, who have refused to support raising or suspending the debt ceiling. Meanwhile, the deadlock in negotiations has made movers and shakers in financial markets increasingly jittery, sending the cost of insuring exposure to U.S. debt soaring to its highest level in a decade, with financial analysts warning about the growing risk of a default on U.S. debt. Agence France-Presse news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. According to recent Congressional Budget Office estimates, the United States risks defaulting on payment obligations as soon as July, if lawmakers fail to resolve a gridlock and raise the federal borrowing limit. The forecast by the nonpartisan office serving Congress comes as Republicans threaten to block the usually rubber stamp approval for raising the nation's credit limit if Democrats do not first agree to steep future budget cuts. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, said if the debt limit remains unchanged, the government's ability to borrow using extraordinary measures will be exhausted between July and September of 2023. The latest estimate provides another benchmark on top of the Treasury Department's expectations. In January, the U.S. hit its $31.4 trillion borrowing cap, prompting the Treasury to start measures that allow it to continue financing the government's activities. The Treasury earlier said its cash and extraordinary measures would likely last until early June. The Congressional Budget Office warned recently if the debt limit is not raised or suspended before the extraordinary measures are exhausted, the government would be unable to pay its obligations fully. As a result, the government would have to delay making payments for some activities, default on its debt obligations, or even both. The Congressional Budget Office said, but the date when measures are exhausted remains uncertain, as the timing and amount of revenue collections and spending could differ from projections. The statement added, in particular, if collections fall short, the Treasury could run out of funds before July. The White House accuses Republicans of taking the U.S. economy hostage in order to posture as fiscally responsible. Recently, Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told reporters, "We're continuing to speak to how bad it would be to allow the nation to default. It's going to affect every American family badly." In a separate report released recently, the Congressional Budget Office said it projects a federal budget deficit of $1.4 trillion for 2023. This amounts to 5.3% of gross domestic product or GDP and is set to reach 6.9% of gross domestic product GDP in 2033, a level exceeded only five times since 1946, and a shortfall is set to hit $2.7 trillion in 2033. Meanwhile, the Congressional Budget Office said that the debt to gross domestic product ratio is expected to rise each year, hitting a record high of 118% by 2033. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, added, debt would continue to grow beyond 2033 if current laws generally remained unchanged.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
LaShawn Thompson was found dead in his cell in an Atlanta jail with more than 1,000 insect bites all over his body. His body was discovered in a filthy jail cell in September, ignored by medical staff and eaten by insects and bugs. The United States holds the most prisoners in the world. Many of the thousands of prisons, jails, and correctional facilities around the country are in deplorable and inhumane conditions. Millions of Americans are held in these facilities with little hope of staying out after being released, since most find their way back to prison one way or another. Hellhole. The United States is home to the world's largest prison system, with close to 2 million people behind bars. The conditions in U.S. jails and prisons are often inhumane, with overcrowding, violence, and inadequate health care plaguing the system. Many prisoners are also subject to long periods of solitary confinement, which can cause severe mental and physical harm. The massive number of prisoners are held in 1,566 state prisons, 98 federal prisons, 3,116 local jails, 1,323 juvenile correctional facilities, 181 immigration detention facilities, and 80 Indian country jails, as well as military prisons, civil commitment centers, state psychiatric hospitals, and prisons in U.S. territories. LaShawn Thompson was held in one of the thousands of these facilities, left to die and eaten alive by bugs and insects.
The image is hard to look at. 35-year-old LaShawn Thompson, unresponsive in a Fulton County jail cell, covered in what his family's attorney says are insect and bedbug bites.
The scene was so horrific that the detention officer said she would not even administer CPR when they found him, because she was freaked out. In her words, freaked out by the...
Thompson suffered from mental health issues and was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was placed in a psychiatric ward in jail 3 months before his death. Prisoners in the U.S. face significant barriers to accessing adequate health care. Many prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses such as diabetes and heart disease, but are often denied necessary medication and treatment. The result is that many prisoners suffer unnecessarily and are at risk of dying from preventable illnesses.
They are overcrowded, they are underfunded. In many cases, the way they're designed, the newer ones even, the way they're designed, they're putting a bunch of people in these pods in these areas, these community areas, with the cells attached, where they pretty much have to police themselves within the pods, within the tiers, which is what you see in places like El Salvador, maybe, in countries where they just put people away in these facilities, and then they basically just lock them away. And that's kind of what you're getting these days on a smaller scale, on a more unique, individualized scale in these jails. What happened with LaShawn Thompson is unbelievable. It is immoral. It is amoral. And it must not be allowed to continue.
The result of the official autopsy carried out on LaShawn Thompson came out as, quote, undetermined, end quote. Now, autopsies cost between $20,000 to $50,000, and Thompson's family would not be able to afford it.
Those behind bars receive from guards and deputies who patrol an indisputable exclusive found Dylan Camerod was beaten by officers at a Michigan jail. He was a former MMA fighter. In 2019, Terry Whitehead would be beaten by former corrections officer David M. Schwartz. These punishments happen at all times of the day.
One factor contributing to the crisis in U.S. jails and prisons is a lack of focus on rehabilitation and reintegration. Many prisoners are released back into society without the necessary skills or resources to succeed, leading to high rates of recidivism. Moreover, many former prisoners are unable to secure employment or housing due to their criminal record, perpetuating a cycle of poverty and crime. And without greater investment in education, job training, and mental health care, this cycle is likely to continue.
all of a sudden you're pulled over, you're taken into custody. Often your family is not notified for hours, if not days thereafter. And because of the pretrial system that exists in America, if you do not have money to bond out, or if you do not have someone who can post a cash bond for you to be released, you have to stay in custody until such time as you can go to trial. During this period of time, as you can imagine, you've often lost your job if you had a job. You've lost your car if you had car payments. You've lost your apartment if you needed to pay rent. All of your possessions have been either thrown out or auctioned off. Even if you are found not guilty and do not proceed to prison, your life often has to be restarted from scratch as a result of charges against you because of the barriers to justice that exist in America.
The disproportionate impact of the U.S. prison system on marginalized communities must be addressed. Black and Latino individuals are incarcerated at significantly higher rates than white individuals, often as a result of systemic racism and poverty. The result is that these communities are disproportionately affected by the negative impacts of the prison system, including the perpetuation of poverty and the destruction of families. How does mass incarceration affect African-American communities?
I know a lot of people who are real activists in this cause have been incarcerated before, and I'm one of them. I was incarcerated for a year in Richmond and for about a month here in Tampa. This is a long time ago. But I can tell you that from that time, in places where you, cities where you don't particularly think of African Americans as the majority, in the prison population, they certainly are. So I've seen this firsthand. Yes, it is a disproportionate percentage of the population in the prisons, in jails, in the penal system. And the cost on the communities is extensive. There's the cost of family members having to take care of them. There's the cost of constantly worrying about the future of what's going to happen to you. There's the cost that when young people see it as possible, as more likely in their community, their future will be in a prison rather than in a college. And it is based on the reality in which they live. The cost of that is extensive.
The U.S. prison system is a profitable industry. Prisons and correctional facilities across the country generate billions of dollars in revenue each year, largely through the incarceration of individuals. One way in which prisons make money is through the use of inmate labor. Prisoners are often forced to work in various industries, including manufacturing, agriculture, and call centers, without any real compensation. So does inmate labor resemble slavery?
Ava DuVernay, the filmmaker, had a documentary several years ago called The 13th, about the 13th Amendment, which the post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, were meant to end slavery, to give constitutional rights to African Americans, and to give them the right to vote. However, states and federal prisons have found ways to abrogate this prohibition against slavery through the inmate labor system. Inmates are often contracted to work in state projects for pennies and hours, same wages that you would expect in any slave camp around the world. We're talking about printing license plates for 5 cents an hour, doing landscaping projects. There was a scheme in Georgia several years ago to ban illegal immigrant labor in America and then replace that with cheap prison labor in order to help the agricultural industry. This is clearly an effort to reinstitute the type of serfdom and plebiscite labor that was very endemic after the Civil War in the United States of America.
In addition, private prisons have become an increasingly popular way to profit off of incarceration. These for-profit facilities are owned and operated by private companies who get into contracts with state and federal governments to house inmates. Private prisons often prioritize profits over rehabilitation and safety, leading to lower standards of care and increased violence within the facilities. So how does the profit-driven U.S. prison system affect the quality of the care of inmates?
Reagan administration, America went through this process of privatization of the prison system. As a result, the states now pay private prisons to incarcerate individuals. Then these prisons are paid by the number of people that they can keep in those prison cells. So there's a perverse incentive to keep people locked up and to keep them locked up longer. And because you have a profit-driven capitalistic model, of course prisons are incentivized as for-profit companies to provide the most substandard care possible. Because there are very few rights that are accorded to prisoners, because there are very few opportunities to complain or to be heard for prisoners, because they're often pariahs in society.
The profit-driven nature of the U.S. prison system has led to a number of ethical concerns, including questions about the quality of care provided to incarcerated individuals, the impact on communities and families, and the role of private corporations in the criminal justice system. Critics argue that the profit motive creates perverse incentives to incarcerate more individuals, limit access to rehabilitation services, and cut corners on safety and health standards.
Along with the privatization comes deregulation, and nobody is looking into it. Nobody is checking up. It's like the case with Fauchon. How could that possibly have come to that kind of nightmare where that young man was living for that long? How could that have happened in our system? And the answer to that question is nobody was looking. Nobody was looking because it doesn't profit them to see the blemishes, to see the holes in the system. It doesn't. That's what privatization of prisons does. It turns it into a. It's not a moral question anymore. It's one of business. And there are no morals in business.
Perhaps one of the most controversial aspects of the U.S. prison system is the use of solitary confinement. Many prisoners are placed in solitary confinement for extended periods, sometimes for years at a time. This practice is known to cause severe mental and physical harm, leading to long-term mental health problems and even suicide. Despite this, the use of solitary confinement continues to be widespread in U.S. prisons, often as a form of punishment for minor infractions.
6 foot by 9. For 23 hours a day.
I wake up soaking wet, sweating sometime.
For decade after decade.
I just feel as though you're being squeezed to death.
Now imagine doing all of that alone. It is a reality for tens of thousands of prisoners in America.
Solitary confinement is a practice of isolating inmates in a cell for 22 to 24 hours a day, with limited or no human interaction, exercise, or access to educational or recreational programs. In the U.S., it's estimated that around 80,000 prisoners are held in solitary confinement on any given day. The practice is controversial, and many human rights organizations, medical experts, and lawmakers have called for its abolition, citing its detrimental effects on mental health and rehabilitation.
Solitary confinement is a clear violation of the United States Constitution. In spite of this, it is often used as a method for inmate control for individuals who are incarcerated. The Eighth Amendment has a clear prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. I think that any rational person would say that locking a human being away in a concrete cell with no access to sunlight, no access to fresh running water, no human interaction for up to 20 20 hours or 22 hours a day with very short respites in order to step outside, eat, and often defecate would be a cruel and unusual punishment. The effects of these can be often long-term, if not lifetime, mental health damage as a result of solitary confinement. Inmates who have returned home have talked about having post-traumatic stress disorder. They've talked about the trauma, the nightmares that persist throughout the remainder of their lives, the inability to function and interact with human beings, the inability to form relationships after being locked away in confinement of that nature, well, for sometimes years at a time. The jails use the excuse that is about controlling the inmate population. However, because of the constitutional prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, this should not be allowed. It would not be allowed.
An Indiana inmate, Joshua McLemore, lost 45 pounds over 20 days of solitary confinement and basically starved to death in 2021. 28-year-old McLemore was mentally ill and placed naked in solitary confinement without any medical or mental care after he had pulled a nurse's hair in the hospital. Video surveillance shows he would go into psychosis episodes, and Jackson County jail staff do nothing for him while he slowly deteriorates and dies.
Confinement is a way to turn a borderline criminal, misdemeanor type criminal into a felon. It's torture. It's the antithesis for what you want to do. The point of prison isn't just to punish. The point of prison is to rehabilitate so that you don't have recidivism. You don't have people coming back into the prison system every time you open the door and let them back out. It's not just a fear model, but it's a rehabilitation model. And so many countries all across the world do such a better job with recidivism, with keeping people from going back into the jails, getting people ready to become part of the communities and feel connected to the communities. If you isolate somebody for, I mean, we're talking in some cases years they keep people in isolation. This isolation technique, this was something that was used in prison camps during wars or prisoner of wars, where you would isolate people and you would put them and lock them away in little cells for years and years until the end of the war. It creates monsters.
The U.S. prison system must address the issue of racial bias and discrimination. Black and Latino individuals are disproportionately represented in the prison population, often as a result of systemic racism in law enforcement and the justice system. This is evident in the harsher sentences imposed on people of color for the same crimes as their white counterparts. Nothing has been truly done to address this issue, and as the years go by, the situation seems to get only worse.
Indeed, the founding document of America, the Constitution, enshrines within it that African Americans will be treated as 3/5 of a human being for purposes of representation in the United States. This system of oppression of African Americans has continued until the present day, because what we have found is that in America there is a clear correlation between poverty, between education, between health care, and further incarceration later in life. Because of this, when you look at the historic system of oppression of African Americans, the lack of access to proper housing through systems of redlining, the lack of access to job opportunities through racism and segregation, the lack of access to health care and educational opportunities through segregation and substandard schooling systems, this has led directly to the place what we see right now, where you have a disproportionate representation of African Americans in the nearly 2.2 million people in the United States who are currently incarcerated. You have a system that is in place which puts barriers to justice, particularly along racial lines in the United States of America. And the fact that there is no appetite to handle these issues, that there has been nothing along the lines of a Truth and Reconciliation Council, there's been nothing along the lines of a conversation or even an apology from the United States government for slavery and segregation.
In the United States, they call solitary confinement the secure housing unit or the SHU program, which is the special holding unit, or they call it simply the hole. Prisoners are held in the hole for punishment, security reasons, or simply because they're being transferred to another prison. In a country with only 10 cities with populations over a million, jails and prisons in America hold more than 2 million people. Going to the hole in U.S. prisons for months is very common, and many Americans who have been incarcerated know that they will probably someday end up back in the hellhole.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. On today's episode, we are going to take a look at the American prison system and how it's been a genocidal death camp since its inception. First and foremost, the American prison system is a genocidal system that has its roots in the enslavement of Africans through chattel slavery. It is a murderous system that continues to kill people day in and day out, and it's been doing this since the founding of this country. And the foundation of the American economy is literally based on chattel slavery, which evolved into the modern day prison plantation system that we see today. Just like its predecessor of chattel slavery, the prison system, it enslaves people and forces them to work for pennies in comparison to the labor and products that are being produced. This has all been legalized through the good old 13th Amendment of the Constitution, which legalizes slavery when one is being punished for a crime. Almost instantaneously after this amendment to the Constitution was made, being black and simply breathing was criminal. And today, more than a third of black men are under correctional control, which is literally more than was enslaved during chattel slavery. By doing this, it's literally created a revolving door for black men to go in and out of prisons, which is profitable for America. The legalization of slavery, it allows for the government and corporations to rake in billions upon trillions of dollars in profit. People can literally get jobs the first day in prison, but can't find jobs when they are out in the streets. And the conditions of prisons in the United States are beyond humane. These prisons, they wouldn't even be considered humane for animals. These American prisons are essentially a death camp. In 2019, a total of 1,200 people died in local jails, and 77% of the 1,200 people who died in these jails were not convicted of a crime. And more data, it shows that in 2020, there were 6,182 deaths, which was a 61% increase to the prior year. And this is all happening despite the fact that the prison population dropped 10%. A recent example of a case that has gotten national attention is the tragic and inhumane and torturous death of LaShawn Thompson. LaShawn was found dead in a jail cell, and according to the Thompson family's attorney, he was eaten alive by insects and bedbugs. And photos of his body, they show his body completely ravaged by insect bites. What else do we call this other than genocidal terrorism? It's something completely evil and satanic that prison guards will literally watch and let a person be murdered by insects. Yet America itself, it continually tries to play like it's some good guy and like it's on some type of moral high ground. But in the belly of the beast inside America, the U.S. government is systematically killing its own quote-unquote citizens in the prisons and in the streets. The question is, why aren't people in America standing up? Why is it that the average American will say we need to go and get and install justice in other countries when America herself is the biggest Satan of them all? It can truly be said that to believe in the state of America is to be in a state of delusion, because America is a genocidal nation that has blood on its hands, not only within this country, but throughout the world too. This is Power to the People.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
According to World Trade Organization, global food prices are likely to soar higher in 2023. According to the organization, costs shot up by nearly 20% last year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further